Hello, and welcome to this audio edition of Philip Huscher's program notes for upcoming concerts by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I'm Rich Caparola. Concerts by the CSO on Thursday, March 14th through Saturday, the 16th, feature guest conductor Jakub Hruscha and violin soloist Josef Spacek. The program includes Also sprach Zarathustra by Richard Strauss, with Josef Spacek, the Violin Concerto No. 1 by Bohuslav Martinu, and a suite from The Miraculous Mandarin by Béla Bartók. Here are Philip Huscher's program notes on Thus Spake or Also sprach Zarathustra by Richard Strauss, the performance time around 35 minutes. Without music, life would be an error, Friedrich Nietzsche wrote. The German philosopher was an accomplished pianist and a competent composer. He wrote mainly choral works, songs, and piano pieces, and music was his greatest passion. The central defining event in his life was his acquaintance with Richard Wagner, which progressed from adulation of the fanatical sort that Wagner particularly encouraged to disillusionment, rejection, and finally, radical estrangement. Nietzsche's influential prose poem, Also sprach Zarathustra, Thus Spoke Zarathustra, wasn't even a decade old when Strauss picked up a copy while on holiday in Egypt late in 1892. Strauss was then the hottest new name in the music world following the success of his tone poems, Don Juan and Death and Transfiguration. He particularly identified with Nietzsche's polemic against organized religion, and he was intrigued with the idea of the Übermensch, the superman who overcomes the finiteness of life and rises above what Nietzsche called Christian herd morality. But Strauss didn't at first think of Zarathustra as a musical subject. He had gone to Egypt to escape Munich's bitter winter. He had suffered from severe bronchitis the previous spring, and to finish his opera, Guntram. The opera proved to be a commercial failure. Personally, it was more rewarding. Strauss married its leading soprano, Paulina de Anna, a few months after the premiere. But Strauss's next tone poem, Till Eulenspiegel's Merry Pranks, was a triumph, and he continued to write orchestral music. Early in the winter of 1896, Strauss decided to make Zarathustra the hero of a new tone poem. Nietzsche's work has cast an unusually strong spell over composers. Mahler's Third Symphony, Delius's A Song of Life, Lucas Foss's Time Cycle are among the works it has inspired, and Nietzsche even said that it could be thought of as a musical composition itself. The prose poem, organized in four parts, contains 82 brief and highly varied reflections on the human condition. The titles range from On the Flies in the Marketplace to On Involuntary Bliss, each one ending with the line, Thus Spoke Zarathustra. Strauss picked 8 of Nietzsche's topics that suggested music to him and arranged them without regard for Nietzsche's original sequence or overall intent to allow for the development of certain purely musical ideas. We don't know what Nietzsche thought of Strauss's effort, but the tone poem was quickly acclaimed as one of the composer's finest works, and it proved to be a score of considerable influence. Bartók was inspired to devote his life to composition after hearing the Budapest premiere in 1902. When Strauss's Also sprach Zarathustra was performed in Berlin shortly after the Frankfurt premiere, the composer commented, I did not intend to write philosophical music or portray Nietzsche's great work musically. I meant rather to convey in music an idea of the human race, from its origins through its various phases of development, both religious and scientific, up to Nietzsche's idea of the Übermensch. The whole symphonic poem is intended as my homage to the genius of Nietzsche, which found its greatest exemplification in Also sprach Zarathustra. Strauss also slips in a disclaimer into the score's subtitle, Tone Poem for Large Orchestra Freely After Nietzsche, the way that movies today are often advertised as loosely based on actual events. Strauss conceived his work as one continuous movement. The 8 chapter headings are printed in the score, but the divisions between sections aren't always easy to hear. The music is governed by the use of 2 keys, C and B, their roots so close and yet their harmony so far apart, to represent the unyielding force of nature on one hand and the ever-searching spirit of man on the other. Taking his cue from Nietzsche, Strauss begins at sunrise, and there are few sunrises in music or in nature more spectacular. The familiarity of this passage from Kubrick's 1968 film 2001, and from its unfortunate use in countless subsequent television commercials, has perhaps dimmed its luster for many listeners. At the head of the score, Strauss printed the opening lines of Nietzsche's prologue, in which Zarathustra descends from the mountains where he has lived for 10 years and addresses the sun. Above the lowest C's the orchestra can provide, in the contrabassoon, string, basses, and organ over a timpani roll, Strauss writes a three-note motif of nearly irreducible simplicity, C, G, C, rising an octave to signify nature. Once the sun rises, quickly and brilliantly, it's every bit as noisy as the dawn in Wagner's Gitterdämmerung, Strauss begins his condensed traversal of Nietzsche's work. Strauss first takes on religion. In Of the Backworldsman, the first of the 8 chapters taken from Nietzsche, he sketches those who are naively imprisoned by their concern with the afterlife. The horns intone the first phrase of the chant, Credo in unum Deum, I believe in one God. Strauss even writes the words into the horn part, and the strings, subdivided into as many as 20 parts, begin a passage of luscious yet self-indulgent beauty. On the Great Longing depicts man's desire to move beyond ignorance. The tonal worlds of B and C begin to collide, and at the peak of activity, Strauss moves directly into On Joys and Passions, in which the conflict between spirituality and sensual abandon grows increasingly heated. In The Grave Song, Zarathustra laments man's plight. His voice is taken by oboe and English horn solos. And in On Science, he turns to learning for illumination. Nietzsche's word, Wissenschaft, carries the broader meaning of scholarship and erudition. Strauss writes a strict, methodical fugue on a theme that contains all 12 notes of the chromatic scale. It begins with the three-note nature motif in C major, followed by three notes of the B minor scale. At the climax of the fugue, Strauss begins The Convalescent, detailing Zarathustra's breakdown and healing, a large and vigorous passage that develops many earlier ideas and peaks with a flashback of the C major sunrise, followed by an entire measure of silence, and then the darkness of B minor. Strauss couldn't resist calling on his famous namesakes, the other Strausses, in The Dance Song, where Zarathustra succumbs to a picture-postcard rendition of a Viennese waltz led by a solo violin. Composed 13 years before his opera, Der Rosenkavalier, this is the first of Richard's many waltzes. At the sumptuous climax of the dance, a bell begins to toll 12 times, progressively diminishing the music's force to a mere whisper. This is the Night Wanderer's Song, based on the famous passage in Nietzsche beginning, O Mensch, gib acht, O man, take heed, where each line in the poem should be followed by the ringing of a bell. This is the text Mahler sets in his Third Symphony. The music gradually fades to silence as the tonalities of B and C jockey for a final word in a precarious and unsettling cliffhanger conclusion. Program notes by Philip Huscher on Also sprach Zarathustra by Richard Strauss. And now on to Bohuslav Martinu's Violin Concerto No. 1, a work lasting about 24 minutes. When the Boston Symphony gave the world premiere of Bohuslav Martinu's Violin Concerto in December 1943, the composer did not mention that he had written an earlier violin concerto and that it had never been performed. He simply said cryptically that the form of a violin concerto had been on his mind for a long time. But 10 years before, Martinu had in fact composed a violin concerto, his first, the one performed on this concert, and that it was sitting unknown among his papers. It would take another 30 years and more than a decade after the composer's death before this first violin concerto would come to light and would be given its world premiere by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra with violinist Josef Suk, conducted by Sir George Schulte in Orchestra Hall. For some time, the manuscript of the concerto had been housed 15 miles north of Orchestra Hall as part of the Hans Moldenhauer archives at Northwestern University at Evanston. According to Moldenhauer, a German-born musicologist and inexhaustible collector of rare musical treasures, countless manuscripts, sketches, and correspondence, in 1961 he was approached by Boz Piller, a former contrabassoon player in the Boston Symphony, who was looking for a home for his own musical autograph materials. Piller had become a close friend of Martinu, and his collection included a number of the composer's papers. That is how Moldenhauer discovered the manuscript for this violin concerto. 10 years later, after Moldenhauer heard the violinist Josef Suk play one of Mozart's concertos with the Chicago Symphony, he felt that he had found the right match with the unknown score and proposed that Suk introduce Martinu's first violin concerto to the world, first in Chicago, then in Prague. Strangely enough, Moldenhauer wrote at the time of the Chicago premiere, not even Martinu's closest associates even knew of the work's existence. The score apparently began with a suggestion from Samuel Duszkin, the Polish-born violinist whose name was already inextricably linked with Stravinsky's violin concerto, which he had introduced in 1931 in Berlin. Duszkin and Martinu met in Paris, where Martinu had moved from his hometown of Polička in eastern Bohemia, Czechoslovakia, in 1923 on a state grant that would support him for 3 months. He ended up staying in Paris for 17 years. Martinu thrived in Paris, then the artistic capital of Europe. He studied with Albert Roussel, made the acquaintance of Serge Koussevitzky, who would later introduce his music to the United States, and began to mingle with members of a wide variety of artistic circles. Perhaps most unpredictably, he fell in love with the new jazz style that was just taking Paris by storm. Martinu was also fascinated by Stravinsky's works at the time, and so perhaps the connection to Duszkin appealed to him for that reason. When Miloš Savranec wrote a biography of Martinu in 1962, he recalled frequent and sometimes heated exchanges between Martinu and Duszkin over various details in the score, and that work on the concerto progressed somewhat stubbornly as a series of revisions and alterations. As a result, he said, the concerto was never finished, and the manuscript had mysteriously disappeared. For years, it was given up as lost. Martinu's first violin concerto has three movements in the conventional fast-slow-fast arrangement. Their tempo markings, however, were determined by Suk and Schulte after they saw that Martinu had never added any such indications to his manuscript. The opening Allegro Moderato is the most substantial of the three. Throughout the movement, the violin solo part is filled with arpeggios, harmonics, and double, triple, and quadruple stops, the kind of bravura fireworks that suggest the powerful and possibly contentious influence of Duszkin, who thrived on showing off virtuoso effects at high speed. Martinu knew the instrument's capabilities as well, having learned to play the violin as a boy. The Andante is broad and flowing with a highly expressive violin melody that never ceases to find new ways to embellish and amplify the idea of simple alternating tones with which it begins. At one point, Martinu wrote a solo violin cadenza to lead directly into the third movement, but later crossed it out in the manuscript, leaving only a single note, the sustained A of the violin, to join the two movements. The finale is a brilliant, dance-like rondo merging Duszkin's virtuosity with Martinu's more lyrical instincts. A postscript about Martinu in America. In 1940, Martinu was blacklisted by the Nazis. On June 10th, 4 days before the Germans entered Paris, the Martinus fled the city, leaving all their possessions behind, and for the next several months, they were homeless and often slept on railway platforms. they finally gained passage on the Exeter, which left Lisbon, Portugal for Hoboken, New Jersey on March 21, 1941. Martineau found it difficult to think of New York City as his new home. He was overwhelmed by the pace of the city and suffered frequent spells of depression. As a kind of welcoming gesture, Koussevitzky commissioned Martineau to compose his First Symphony, which was premiered in Boston in 1942, the first of six he would write during the 16 years he lived in this country, and invited him to teach at Tanglewood. In 1955, Martineau took American citizenship, but he left the U.S. in 1957 and settled in Switzerland, where he died in 1959. 20 years later, his body was moved to the family plot in Polichka. A postscript about the concerto. When Suk and Schulte gave the world premiere of the 40-year-old concerto in Chicago in 1973, Martineau's other violin concerto, which from now on would be identified as No. 2, had long ago entered the orchestra's repertory. Désiré Defoe conducted with Misha Elman as soloist in November 1944. The night Schulte introduced the new concerto, October 25, 1973, he began the concert with the Adagietto from Mahler's Fifth Symphony in memory of Pablo Casals, who had died early that week at the age of 96. Program notes by Philip Huscher on the Bohuslav Martineau Violin Concerto No. 1. And now on to a suite from Béla Bartók's The Miraculous Mandarin. The suite lasts about 21 minutes. After The Miraculous Mandarin, Bartók never again attempted to write music for the theater. His first stage works, the opera Bluebeard's Castle and the ballet The Wooden Prince, fared well enough, although it took 6 years to get the opera produced, but The Miraculous Mandarin gave Bartók continual difficulty. For the rest of his career, he wrote only concert works, a decision that produced a number of masterpieces but denied the development of his theatrical talent. In 1917, while he was putting the finishing touches on The Wooden Prince, Bartók read Menihet Lengyel's libretto for The Miraculous Mandarin in a Hungarian literary magazine. Lengyel had his sights set on the combination of Sergei Diaghilev's Russian troupe and the composer Ernő Dohnányi to create a ballet based on his scenario. Bartók immediately informed Lengyel of his interest in the story and began to write music. His first sketches date from August 1917. He worked on the piano score in 1918, early 1919, completing the orchestration in 1923, and made further revisions the following year. Although a piano reduction was published in 1925, Bartók wasn't satisfied with the ending. He had similar trouble with the conclusion of Bluebeard's Castle, and he continued to fuss with it. He didn't put his final thoughts on paper until 1931. When Bartók discovered that Universal Editions, his Viennese publisher, was advertising the Mandarin as a ballet, he protested, "I have to observe that this work is less a ballet than a pantomime, since only two dances actually occur in it. It would therefore be much more practical to call it a pantomime." Even before he finished orchestrating the score, Bartók began to doubt that he would ever see the work staged. In fact, the performance history of The Miraculous Mandarin is marked by such formidable struggles that the score didn't receive the acclamation it deserves until after the composer's death. Only then did musicians understand that it was Bartók's greatest work to date. In 1927, he himself wrote, "In my view, this is the best work I have so far written for orchestra." It is the strongest of his three stage works and his first statement in his unique, mature style. Had The Miraculous Mandarin been staged under different circumstances, it might have earned a page in history books alongside the scandalous premiere of Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring, because it is music of equally gripping power and invention. In 1913, when Paris was reeling from the shock of The Rite of Spring, Bartók was in Algeria collecting folk songs. At the time he drafted The Miraculous Mandarin, he knew Stravinsky's score by reputation and in a piano reduction. The premiere of The Miraculous Mandarin in the conservative city of Cologne in November 1926 caused an uproar. The audience walked out. The conductor was officially reprimanded by the mayor, Konrad Adenauer, and the work was subsequently banned. But Cologne wasn't at the heart of the music world, and it wasn't the composer's hometown. The incident passed without making international headlines. The Miraculous Mandarin wasn't staged in Budapest until 1946, after the composer's death, and a quarter of a century after the score was finished. A production in Budapest had been announced in 1931 as part of the celebration honoring Bartok's 50th birthday, but it was canceled after the dress rehearsal when officials got wind of the work's subject matter. Another performance, scheduled for 1941, was opposed by the clergy. The problems were both the graphic, intense music and the story, a violent and erotic tale with implicit social criticism. In 1927, sensing that the odds were against ever getting the work staged, Bartok made the orchestral suite that's performed at these concerts from the full ballet score. It's in this form, essentially the first two-thirds of the complete ballet, that the Miraculous Mandarin has become known. Bartok was strongly drawn to Lengel's powerful and fantastic tale. As the Miraculous Mandarin begins, a girl is forced by three thugs to stand in a window, luring men inside to be robbed. Her first two victims, an old rake and a shy young man, are penniless. The third, the eerie but wealthy Mandarin, presents a horrifying challenge. The girl finds him repulsive, but she slowly begins her dance of seduction. The thugs attack and rob the Mandarin. Three times they try to kill him, but the Mandarin will not die. His eyes are fixed with longing on the girl. When she finally embraces him, he falls lifeless to the ground. The suite stops just before the thugs attack the Mandarin. Bartok carefully underlines the story's design. Three times the music begins from a total standstill and builds to a shattering climax. Each section, or decoy game, as Bartok calls it, represents one of the seductions. Bartok uses orchestration to articulate form, launching each seduction with a solo clarinet and marking each of the murder attempts with cymbal crashes. Bartok begins with the noise and frenzy of the urban landscape. Late in his life, he admitted that New York City traffic frightened him terribly. After the clarinet signals the first decoy game, a lewd old man is depicted by the sound of raucous trombone slides. The attack of the thugs brings a furious orchestral outburst. The second decoy game introduces a shy young man accompanied by a gentle oboe solo. He dances with the girl, cautiously at first, then with unexpected passion. Again, the thugs attack. For the third time, the clarinet announces a decoy game, and at the Mandarin's entrance, the trombones let out three shattering cries. The music stops, except for two notes in the horns, sustained forever, it seems, like the Mandarin's piercing gaze. A slow dance of seduction begins. A waltz starts, falters, and picks up again. A frantic chase ensues. The music builds to a fever pitch, sustained, it seems, almost beyond the breaking point, and although the story itself isn't over yet, the suite ends with music of breathtaking finality. Philip Pusher's program notes on the suite from Bartok's The Miraculous Mandarin. My name is Rich Caparella. Thanks for listening.